My name's Lynn Welsh, and I'm very honoured to have been asked to chair this public debate convened by the Centre for the Study of Global Governance under the title Global Civil Society and the Sex Industry. You'll all, I think, have seen, if you've had an email. Am I not on mic? Is it? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Someone at the back is doing this.
Here.
You can't hear? Well, I'm sort of shouting now.
Maybe bring the mic closer.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. Global Civil Society and the Sex Industry. I don't know how many of you got the email invitations, but there was attached to that an article that could be downloaded by Dr. Perna Sen, who's one of our speakers tonight, part of which forms the basis for this meeting this evening, as I understand it. Part of the idea of this public debate is to try to move forward on the debate that she describes in that article, which is more generally about the global movement to end violence against women, and specifically where she treats in the article about the sex industry under the subtitle Divisions within the Movement. If I can just read you two sentences, those of you who haven't had a chance to read the article will see where the idea of the panel is starting from. There is a growing consensus in many agencies and parts of the world that the sex industry, prostitution, lap dancing, and other activities built around the selling of sex or sexual arousal is growing in both size and monetary value. A considerable proportion of this industry draws upon the trafficking of women and girls across borders. Women's movements against violence tend to be united in opposition to trafficking, but divide vehemently over whether engagement in the sex industry is to be understood as a legitimate area of employment or a site of exploitation and violence. The division operates not only at a conceptual level, how to understand the area, but also plays out in consequent policy and intervention approaches. The fissure is almost absolute, with the camps having little contact with each other. We have this evening five speakers, participants in that debate from differing perspectives, and each of them is going to speak for 8 to 10 minutes, followed at the end by a debate based on question and answer with yourself participating from the audience. I think we aim to wind up around 8 o'clock for those of you who need to have a time to aim at, but we may carry on if the debate continues. I will introduce each speaker in turn, and we are starting with Dr. Perna Sen, who is a lecturer at the Development Studies Institute, LSE, and a visiting research fellow at the Center for the Study of Global Governance, under whose auspices, as I said, tonight's debate has been organized. Perna Sen's work has focused on international human rights, particularly within the context of sexual violence and violence against women and social development issues. Her doctoral thesis investigated women's resistance to domestic violence in Calcutta. She has been involved in international lobbying activities relating to violence against women, especially in India, Jordan, Morocco, and the UK. She has worked and continues to work with women's and refuge NGOs. Dr. Sen, maximum 10 minutes. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Lynn. And thank you, Lynn, for coming to chair tonight. Can you hear me? Nobody's saying yes. Can you hear me now? That's not much better either. Okay, I'm going to go for it. What I want to kick off with tonight is some contextualization of the debate that we're going to engage in this evening. And I want to place it very much within the context of a global movement to end violence against women, a movement which has been extremely successful, particularly over the last 25 years or so, which has been very successful in challenging and changing perceptions of violence against women, making the whole area of domestic violence, rape, sexual assault, abuse of all sorts, sexual harassment, accepted slowly as a public issue which needs addressing. A global movement that has been very successful in discussing and networking across and within national boundaries on this issue. For example, in holding its own as well as attending UN meetings on the issue. a movement which has had very successful campaigns, advocacy and lobbying work around violence against women to the extent that we have now some degree of international consensus on what we mean by violence against women with internationally accepted definitions through the United Nations and of violence against women generally and of rape and pertinent to this debate in particular, definitions of trafficking and what that will mean to us through this coming century we're in now. The movement has been successful at national level in many countries at getting laws and policies moving around violence against women, and as I say, in getting the UN to adopt and accept consensus definitions and new posts around violence against women. So I see the movement against violence against women as being extremely successful, both within countries, across regions, and globally. But as Lynn pointed out, I think there remain incredibly strong debates and divisions within the movement, and one that I find particularly divisive, and I think I use the word vitriolic in the article, I think has been around the issue of prostitution, the sex industry, and pornography. It's one which has been remarkably sharp and aggressive, really, in the way in which it's polarized different sections within the movement. And I'm just going to run very quickly through broadly the parameters of those discussions before our following speakers go into a bit more detail than I will. The debate has been, or the divisions have been, around how we understand and therefore respond to the sex industry, a sex industry which many and increasing numbers of commentators agree is growing in size and in monetary value, and is fed at least in part, perhaps most significantly, by trafficking of women and children. The two broad camps, and I'm slightly caricaturing a little because so that we can see the divisions, the distinctions between them, but the two sides, as it were, are as follows. One which argues that the sex industry and the work that women do within it should be understood as a form of work, a form of labor that women engage in as they do also other forms of work. Within this this form of work, what ought to happen is by seeing it as a legitimate form of work, it should be treated as somewhere where formal working conditions are improved for women, where protections are offered, and in order to do that, legalization would enable standardization or negotiation of conditions of work, rates of pay, leave, and other conditions which workers in other industries also benefit from. It ought to be understood as a form of work that women choose, as they do choose other forms of work too. For this particular argument, the distinction between forced prostitution and free prostitution is significant. So it means that those women who choose to enter the industry ought to be allowed to do so and operate there with protection, and the problem becomes only those who are forced into prostitution. That's why the distinction matters. In order to protect women in the industry, unionization would help to negotiate the sorts of things I've said are helpful about working conditions and so on. And this therefore requires decriminalization of women, of the industry. Less commonly put is an argument around the sex industry as a form of expression of women's sexuality, and as a way in which, a space in which women can safely challenge the constraints and taboos on women's sexual expression that are found elsewhere. I say less commonly put because we don't see those sorts of arguments for legalization as expression very widely put across the world. I've been involved in a number of international initiatives and international negotiations, and the arguments that come from broader parts of the world are around protection and unionization rather than sex industry as a form of expression. On the other hand, the other side of the debate, as it were, will argue that this isn't to be seen as a form of work like any other. Rather, it has features which can never be removed or effectively eliminated, features involving exploitation, abuse, and violence. What this lobby will argue is that prostitution, pornography, and so on are essentially and inherently forms of violence against women and abuses of women's human rights. The violence that marks the initiation and the life that women lead in the sex industry will not be and cannot be erased by legalization. Yes, some women are forced into prostitution, but many are in the industry through deception, through false promises, or abuse of trust or authority. Therefore, understanding women's entry into this industry as a choice is problematic in itself. Women ought not to be punished through criminalization of the industry. The problem, rather than women's entry, is men's demand for women, for women's bodies to be purchased as sexual commodities. And therefore, the way in which to deal with this industry is to problematize the men and criminalize, perhaps, the demand for the sexual services that men are seeking. One minute. Okay, I'm at the end. That's a slightly sketchy map of the debates, but I hope you can see that there is a significant gap between the two rather polarized positions that I've put. What I think is quite interesting to note is that the arguments don't run globally as smoothly as that. What I've seen is that the pro-legalization, the pro-unionization arguments tend to come most forcefully from North America, Western Europe, and Australasia, and certain parts of Southeast Asia. Those who are very, very clearly against prostitution and against legalization tend to be voices from Latin America, Africa, very clearly the Middle East, where in fact it's difficult to debate the topic at all, and parts of South Asia. So that's a very live debate that's continuing, but I think it's very timely for us to look at it with the new trafficking protocol and with perhaps a review of prostitution laws in this country. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Also for keeping to the time. Our next speaker is Martin Smith, who's the London Regional Representative for the General Workers' Union, the GMB, where he has been responsible for a large number of successful recruitment strategies and has written a number of press articles on trade union issues. He's also, pertinent to this meeting in particular, one of the officers responsible for the GMB's campaign on the sex industry.
Thanks. Is that working down here? Yeah. Okay, what I want to do first is, just by introduction, talk a little bit about the GMB in London region, how we're set up, where we're focused, and the culture, and maybe talk about how, as far as we're concerned, we got into this campaign to try and tackle some of the abuses and exploitation in this industry. I am the initial officer that met Anna and started this campaign off to organise this industry. The campaign is actually led by my colleague Lisa Veans, now who's obviously a female officer, who can't be with us tonight. GMB London is part of the GMB nationally. It has 85,000 members. By way of explanation, we have around about 55% of those members are women, about 25% are black and ethnic minority members. We're growing and developing into a lot of new areas now in London. The pizza makers, minicab drivers, door security staff, casino workers, and so on. And we're 2 years into this campaign where we've begun to make a decision to engage with this industry and try and do what we can to tackle some of the abuses. I think it's fair to be clear that in that time we have had a lot of discussions within the GMB with our sisters on the Women's Committee and the Equalities Committee on this, and also the TUC Women's Committee and Equalities Committee. So the position I'm portraying and representing tonight is the GMB collective position and the position essentially of the trade union movement in Britain. In terms of the GMB, we've always had an attitude and approach since the 1890s, certainly in London, of trying to organise and tackle injustice and oppression amongst a group of workers that come to us to ask to be organised. If you go right back to the roots of our union, the first groups of people we organised in London were the gas stokers and the people who followed the horse-drawn carts around London picking up the droppings to sell as a living. And the point I make there is that when the gas lights were new in London and the well-to-do in Chelsea and Kensington were turning their gas lights on, obviously they gave no thought to the workers who were doing 24-hour back-breaking work, stoking the ovens to keep that gas flowing. And we've always taken a view that we are really there for the groups of workers in society and in our city that want to organise themselves and can't organise themselves without the support of other organisations. For us, self-organisation amongst workers is the key in this industry and elsewhere. We want to engage with workers that are facing exploitation, abuse, violence, and work with them on the issues to organise at their workplace where it's relevant, outside the workplace where it's relevant, on the principle of self-organisation, as I say. So our point of view is that when a group of workers comes to us and says, you know, we want to fight for respect in our work, we want to fight against the injustice we face at our work, we take an attitude that the answer is always yes. There's problems come from saying yes, but the answer is always yes. It isn't for us as a trade union to walk away from exploitation and abuse. It's to engage in it and see what we can actually do. And that is just an approach that the GMB takes in London. Myself and Anna met at a conference talking about sweatshop labour. I was talking about a campaign we were trying to organise in the East End of London, in Tower Hamlets, where we were meeting textile workers who were being paid £2.85 an hour. We were challenged by international comrades in Indonesia when we were fighting exploitation in sweatshops to say you really should do this in your own town, where a lot of the clothes on sale in Oxford Street are made by sweatshops in East London. I was there talking about that campaign, and Anna approached me and spoke to me and said, a number of us in this industry are seeking to organise. We're facing these levels of problems in the law. We're facing these levels of problems in terms of abuse. And the question was put directly to us. Can we join the GMB? Will the GMB help us organise? And that is our point of departure for this whole campaign. And we felt, as a union, and our women's committees and equality committees felt, that the only logical answer to that question was yes, despite the discussions that inevitably we would be involved in. And I think the point of view that we take is there's a lot of discussion, and clearly we're going to get onto tonight over the issues around decriminalisation and legalisation and so on, but the clear point of view from the union is that the immediate issue that our members present us with isn't necessarily that. The immediate issue that our members present us with is a lack of ability to get their existing rights under the law. We all know, many in the progressive movement and the trade union movement will know and remember the scandal of the 1980s when judges were refusing to prosecute men who had raped and abused women on the notion of contributory negligence, where effectively that was legal speak for a woman dressed in an allegedly provocative way was asking for it. We now have a situation where members of our union who are sex workers are told by either the police or the Crown Prosecution Service that their case won't be pursued, even where they have evidence of the man who raped and abused them, because consent cannot be established. Our view is that is exactly the same as saying contributory negligence. It says that a sex worker has no right to say no. And of course, our women's committees and our union takes the position we've taken for at least 20 or so years that a woman has a right to say no in every circumstance. And that is one of the positions we take. And we think that the union can, before we get into the debates of decriminalisation and legalisation, the union needs to stand for the existing rights under the law of sex workers. And that's just one example. The final point I'd make by introduction is we've had a lot of debates, as you can imagine, in the past 2 years. One of the issues that has been put to us straightforwardly, and it's a fair question, is whether or not the unionisation and engaging in this industry does mean the same thing as promoting this industry. And it's a discussion that, in a sense, has caused a lot of debate within the trade union movement. And the point I would make is that, from a trade unionist point of view, just looking at this objectively, it sometimes comes as something of a surprise to have the suggestion that somehow or another, when we organise workers in an industry, that does indicate that we take any position on that industry or indeed promote the industry or legitimise it. And without seeking to make moral equivalences around issues that are about our own individual's viewpoint, you know, it is worth bearing in mind that the trade unions do organise Huntington Life Sciences. The trade unions do organise British Aerospace, where they build the Hawk jets that are sent to Indonesia. And the trade unions do organise at Sellafield. Now, we don't necessarily take a view on nuclear industry, the arms manufacturing or the experiments on animals. We may or may not. The issue for us is, whatever the moral position of that industry, those workers have sought our help to organise and tackle the abuse, exploitation and injustice that they face, and that is the first port of call of a trade union. And I'll just make that point and probably finish my initial comments there.
Thank you very much, Martin Smith. Our next speaker is Professor Liz Kelly, who has many years of experience working on issues of violence against women and girls in the UK and elsewhere. And she's currently director of the Child and Woman Abuse Studies Unit based at the London Metropolitan University. She's co-author of a book entitled Stopping Traffic, Exploring the Extent of and Responses to Trafficking in Women for Sexual Exploitation in the UK, together with Linda Reagan, who's also of the same unit. This research study, the only one of its kind in the UK so far, was funded by the Home Office, and it assessed the nature and extent of trafficking in women for the purposes of sexual exploitation and law enforcement responses in the UK. Since that time, Liz Kelly has conducted training for trainers in 7 Balkan countries and in Ethiopia. Currently, she's working on a studying of traffic in stroke from the Central Asian Republics. Professor Kelly.
Okay. One of the things I'm going to draw on in what I want to say tonight is a review that I did with another of my colleagues at the unit of prostitution regimes in four countries. And those four countries were Sweden, Ireland, Australia, and the Netherlands. Just as there's no single feminist position about prostitution, I think it's very important that we remember that there's no unified voice of women who are or have been in the sex industry. For both groups, and they're not mutually exclusive, perspectives range from those who defend prostitution as a realm of freedom to those who regard it as an unparalleled site of sexual oppression and tyranny. And actually, probably most of us in the room are positioned somewhere between those poles. To lay my cards on the table from the outset, I do regard prostitution as an institution that reproduces gender inequality. And I think it's worth remembering that this is not the oldest profession. It actually emerges in human history after slavery, and in some kind of relationship to it as well. However, given what Perna said, one of the things that was very interesting doing this review was actually being confronted with the fact that there are actually quite a lot of areas of consensus that we don't acknowledge between positions that are seen as irreconcilable. And I want to say something about where I think those areas of consensus are. Wherever you're positioned in this debate, most agree that criminalising women is both discriminatory and ineffective. And the one country that's taken a leap in the other direction is actually Sweden, that has decided that it is going to criminalise not the selling of sex, but the purchase of it. It's the only country in the world to do this. Pretty soon Finland is likely to join, and possibly also Iceland. There's also agreement that reactive, short-lived interventions achieve little, if anything, in relation to either prostitution or trafficking. I think we're also in agreement that there are strong links between sex markets, drug markets, and organised crime that are not to the benefit of any of the women who are involved in the sex industry, and that there are huge levels of violence experienced by women in the sex industry. Of any group of women, I think they have levels of victimisation that are distressing in their extent. What, in looking at the regimes, we found that not only had legalisation certainly not controlled trafficking, which is one of the arguments that's put in favour of it, but actually in countries where prostitution is legalised, many, and you could argue the majority of adult women and men, choose not to register, choose not to go through the process that actually allows them to be legal, because the conditions of legalisation in many countries are not ones that are particularly positive or welcome. And a survey of women and men in prostitution in five countries found that less than a third of them actually supported legalisation. We also found that tolerance zones had failed to deliver the hoped-for benefits, perhaps best illustrated by the closure of one in Amsterdam. And the mayor of Amsterdam noted that it had proved impossible to control the involvement of organised crime. I think we're also agreed that in many countries, street prostitution is dangerous for women and has other implications for the communities in which it's based. And whilst off-street prostitution, there's less violence, when it's subject to limited control, you're much more likely to find minors there and trafficked women there. And I want to throw out a few questions for us to think about. These are the things that concern and bother me currently. And I think they're questions we need to engage in on a number of levels. Why are sex industries across the globe increasingly populated by migrant and trafficked women? And we are not talking here just about movements from the south to the north. We're talking about regional sex markets where women are trafficked in, and girls are trafficked from neighbouring poorer countries. So, for example, in India, a lot of the street prostitution is women and girls from Nepal, from Laos and Cambodia. In the Balkans, whilst Albanian and Kosovo women are trafficked west, Moldovan, Romanian and Ukrainian women are trafficked into other Balkan countries. Obviously, one of the reasons is profit. It's clearly a motivating factor. But there is only profit where there is demand. And we have to ask questions about demand in the sex industry, demand for women and girls who are not nationals, who have less power and status than the women who are nationals, and therefore have less power and status to negotiate what Julia Connell Davidson calls a prostitution contract. I think there are issues about racism here, about otherization, and about the construction of masculinities. I think we also have to ask questions about this notion of migrant sex workers, because how do women, who everybody acknowledges are from impoverished contexts, often have limited education, travel huge distances, find their way into sex markets in countries where they often don't speak the language, without the involvement of third parties, without some kind of facilitation, without recruitment, and without some form of debt bondage? I think we have to deal with the fact that the totally legitimate desires of women for a better life, and in many cases to escape things like early marriage, sexual abuse or domestic violence, is actually callously exploited by traffickers. And if we don't interrogate this, we don't see those processes happening, what we do is allow countries not to deal with those issues that actually are the cause of them becoming recruited in the first place. I think we also have to look at the implications of the definition of trafficking in the UN optional protocol, because it does not require force. It doesn't even, the consent of the person to be smuggled trafficked is not relevant if it's proved that they were deceived and or they were exploited for profit in the destination. It doesn't even require movement across borders. And I think it requires us to think very carefully about what are the conditions in which prostitution can be said to be free. I also think we need to think about our notions of women's agency. All women can act in some way, but few are able to do so in conditions of their own choosing. The space for action that many women have is dramatically constrained by the circumstances of their lives and the location in the globe where they live. Globally, very few of those who are currently in the sex industry would choose to remain if they had other sustainable options. And I worry that in emphasising the agency of relatively privileged women, we're simultaneously choosing to marginalise the constrained context of many more. And as importantly, we leave out of the picture altogether the men who are involved as customers and those who exploit and traffic women in the industry. And I think if we're serious about discussing the sex industry, then we have to have all aspects of it in view, and we have to subject them to a critical and a feminist analysis.
Thank you, Liz Kelly. Our next speaker is Anna Lopez, who is a founding member and general secretary of the International Union of Sex Workers. The IUSW developed as a response by a coalition of people within the sex industry to Westminster Council's campaign of eviction of prostitutes. The IUSW works for the rights and social acceptance of sex workers and has forged links with many other groups around the world. Anna Lopez contributes articles and talks to a wide variety of interested parties. Following a membership ballot in March 2002, the International Union of Sex Workers is now affiliated to the GMB, Britain's fourth largest union, spoken about tonight already by Martin Smith. Anna Lopez.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Thank you for the introduction. Apart from being an activist in this area of sex workers' rights, I'm also a student, and as many students, I work in the sex industry. I've been working in an adult chat line for 4 years now. So I work in this very varied industry. We're talking about prostitution, striptease, lap dancing, pornography, phone sex, all the rest of it. And sometimes the difference between one and the other are not very clear or demarcated. Some of my colleagues are in the sex industry because they want to and they like what they do. Some of them hate what they do. And that's, I find it, it's like in any other industry. What I can say is that the majority of us have to do it because we have to earn a living. You can have extremes, but the majority of us, for the majority of us, it's just a job. What is very different about the sex industry is that a lot of it is clandestine, underground, and some of it is illegal. And because of it, there is lots of violence, abuse, exploitation, rape, and trafficking. So I disagree with porn. I think from our perspective, the problem is not only for those who are in the industry against their will. Even those of us who have chosen to be in the industry, who have, you know, looked at our choices and said, okay, this is where I'm going to make my living, we do face all these problems on a daily basis. And these problems are unacceptable, and that's why some of us came together and formed an association which we call the International Union of Sex Workers. And our aim was to establish sex work as a labor issue. We thought that may be a useful way to look at it and to solve or minimize some of these problems. So we started a campaign for labor rights. We thought, well, if we look at it, despite a lot of differences, despite some of us liking what we do, some of us not liking it, we're all workers. None of us does this if, you know, if there wasn't an economic factor behind it, so we're workers. Then in 2002, we gained official union recognition when we joined the GMB. And as Martin said, we think that this kind of unionization is the first step to eliminate exploitation and to empower ourselves. And we think that it's only through empowerment and through establishing our self-respect that we are going to stand up for our rights. Because if we're made to feel ashamed about what we do, then we're not going to have the courage to fight the exploitation and the stigmatization that we face every day. And also, empowerment is also very important, and this establishing self-respect, because it's only when we have some kind of empowerment that we can actually choose to leave the industry. So that has been very important. We now have the support of the majority of the trade union movement, and we count with their help to establish full labor rights. Since we've established our branch, we've signed union recognitions with a few table dancing clubs. And the working conditions in these table dancing clubs have actually improved. So this means that union involvement does improve workers' conditions as it did in many other industries. Our successful experience with joining an official union has also inspired sex workers in other countries to follow the same route. Nowadays, sex workers are unionized in Sweden. French sex worker activists are working, negotiating with unions over there. And there are unions in other countries. For instance, in Latin America, in Argentina, there's been a sex workers union for a long time. They set up before we did here in the UK. The involvement of the union in this industry through providing training has enabled people to either do their jobs in a safer way and have more control over their work and their working conditions, and it has also enabled people to leave the industry, because it's very ironic that we're so stigmatized for working in this industry, but then that same stigmatization makes it very difficult for us to leave if we want to leave, because no one else will give us a job. So we need training. We need, you know, training in CV writing and training in other areas so that we can actually find alternative employment. Just the union being there has been empowering for many sex workers. Just the fact that we can meet up, talk about our issues in a friendly, non-judgmental environment is very important. It's something that we didn't have before. We're now working on, of course, establishing more labor rights for all sex workers, using those table dancing clubs as models to, you know, force other clubs to have the same working conditions. And we're also thinking about the legislation. From our point of view, the legislation itself is responsible for many of the vulnerabilities and abuses occurring in the sex industry. For instance, the legislation pushes sex workers to work in dark and isolated areas. It encourages stigma. By not permitting workers to work together, it's just augments and magnifies their vulnerability to violence. So really, the most important point about all this is that this is not about what you think about sex work. This is about supporting us to eliminate abuse and violence in our industry, exploitation. So whether you think that people should have the right to enter the sex industry, or whether you think the whole sex industry should be abolished, you should support us in our fight for better conditions and for the improvement of our lives, both at work and outside work. That support is really very important for us, because it means that you acknowledge that we are citizens, that we deserve human rights like everyone else, and that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ana Lopez. Our fifth and final speaker this evening is Denise Marshall. Denise Marshall is the chief executive of Eve's Housing for Women and has approximately 20 years' experience of working within the voluntary sector in London. Denise has worked with women's organisations, including Women's Aid, and has experience of working with young lesbians and gay men and ex-offenders. Following an in-house review in March 2001, Eve's Housing for Women identified a gap in service provision for trafficked women, and in December 2001 accepted its first trafficked woman. Since the onset of this project, they have accepted 43 women who have been trafficked. Denise Marshall.
Hi. Yes, since March of this year, we've accepted 43 women. Women who've come from Sierra Leone, from Thailand, from Eastern Europe, anywhere where there is a country where there is poverty. Sorry, can you hear me now? We are finding that women are being trafficked from. We have also spoken to women who've been trafficked from Glasgow to London, from Sheffield to Newcastle. Women who have no choices, women who were in care and who got caught up with men who told them that they could find them a better life. And within 6 months, they had them working in King's Cross. None of these women represent one authentic voice. There are many women's experiences, and I don't seek to say that they are the authentic voice, but those are the women that we work with. Of the women who have contacted us since we started the project, and before that, when we ran just our supported housing project, none of those women said to us, this was a positive choice that I made. What they said was poverty, deception, exploitation, a lack of choices, a society that said actually that they weren't worth very much else, that they came from sink estates and went to sink schools, and what else was there for them to do. That's what led the women that we worked with into prostitution. The women that we work with are not interested in and haven't been interested in the rates of pay. They have been interested in getting out. All of the women that we have worked with have felt that they were forced, whether because they were students who were in a system that didn't pay them enough money to live on so that they had no other choices, whether they had children and they couldn't cope on the paltry amount of money that they received, whether they had been deceived. None of them felt that it was forced, that all of them felt it was forced prostitution. None of them felt that it was a free choice. So for us, Legalisation and decriminalisation isn't the answer. What we think of legalisation and decriminalisation is that it's a gift to traffickers and to pimps. That actually, if you look at the experiences in countries where decriminalisation has been tried and legalisation has been tried, what you find is men who join the Rotary Club as businessmen because they were running three or four brothels, and the women who work in it make no more money out of it. The money goes to the men who run the places. What we have found is that legalisation and decriminalisation leads to clandestine and hidden prostitution. In The Hague that I visited recently, the trafficked women with decriminalisation have been pushed out of the brothels and saunas where they had some degree of safety and are working on the streets. So the legislation didn't work for them. It hasn't worked for women in other areas either. Legalisation and decriminalisation has not improved women's health. The women that we work with who, if it was legalised, will still be forced by their trafficker to have a termination and another termination and another termination and go back to work the next day. That's the experience of some of the women that we've worked with. And it doesn't enhance their choice. To enhance their choice, what we need to do is improve the lot of those women in society. I think that's a much better place to start.
Thank you, Denise Marshall. That concludes the opening contributions from the speakers. Do you think we should give them a clap for a first round and then we'll go to... And Adnoy concluded actually before time in most cases. Shall we, I propose we take two or three questions, and then if you do have a particular person to whom you want to address, perhaps you could say. And if you would, we would like your names, and if you want to, your affiliation, if you have an affiliation. If not, I'm sure it's fine. Yes, one here. Can you just hold 1 minute while I just recognise two or three people, and then we can start. Excuse me, sorry. Yes, you're first. You're absolutely first. You're second. No more hands? Oh, right. One, two, two here, three at the back. Okay, and then you can be four. Okay, thank you. Sorry. Okay, thank you. Excuse me, is your question? Thank you. One more before we go into that.
Yeah, a question I think was from Denise Marshall concerning unionisation why I wonder whether you distinguish between those two. Do you think unionisation is necessarily a step to politicisation or not? And secondly, it seems to me that part of your argument, to me, especially, is to say this industry is so exploitative and so unequal that, you know, unionisation and legalisation cannot make it better, cannot be the answer. I kind of think, if I go back in history about factory work in this country in the 19th century, you might make the same argument that, you know, it was so inhuman, so exploitative and so unequal that, you know, no one should be forced to. Yet unionisation has completely changed that. And in this country, although not elsewhere, factory work, I think, is generally not considered as inhuman because conditions have improved so So what do you think that analogy is for?
Thank you. I think we'll just take some answers to be going on with. Martin, do you, or Anna, do you want to start, or would you like?
Okay, so the first question is about the difference between sex industry and trafficking. I think that we should really make that distinction very clear. Trafficking is an abuse, and it's something that, you know, I think I can say that there is a consensus, we're all against it. But it's not the, not all people working in the sex industry have been trafficked. Then we went on to legislation. I think maybe they will respond to that.
Not everybody has to answer all of them, by the way.
And I'm really glad that someone raised the point that the sex industry is not only, you know, populated by women. We have men and transgender workers, and that's why I don't know how the argument that the that prostitution or sex work is, you know, inherently violence against women can be validated, because there's so many other people working in the industry.
Okay, thank you. Liz, did you want to make a comment at the same questions directly too?
Okay. I think you can and you can't make a distinction between trafficking and the sex industry. Trafficking is one element in the sex industry. It is not separate or different from it, because people are trafficked into sex industries. They are part of those working in it, exploited in it, wherever we want to look in the globe. So you can't totally separate them out and say they're different things. They are, trafficking is an element of sex industries. I agree that legislation is problematic and causes problems for anyone who's in the sex industry. My problem is that I don't believe that legalisation takes away the stigma, lessens the violence, or the exploitation. If you look at countries that have legalised sex industries, their illegal sector is bigger than it was before they legalised. People who want to exploit, and many owners and businesses do want to exploit, want to use trafficked women, they cannot be in the legal sector. So it's not that I think we have good law. I do not think we have good law. I don't think changing the law resolves some of the issues that we're here tonight to discuss. I don't have a problem with unionisation. My argument again would be that I actually don't think it's going to deliver, and it can't deliver some of the things in all sectors of the sex industry. You can change conditions if you're talking about a lap dancing club, if you're talking about a place, a location, where that some kind of monitoring can take place. How can you do that in terms of street prostitution? It's not the same thing. So,
Martin, did you want to respond to any of those?
Yeah, I just want to make a quick comment on migrant labour, which the colleague at the back mentioned, and clearly that's a massive issue in the industry. Of course, we talk about the sex workers as including everyone, dancers, you know, people working in videos and the whole range. And it's clearly one of the biggest issues in terms of trying to organise any industry, and clearly it's one of the biggest issues in the whole argument about decriminalisation and some regulation in the industry. The only point I would make, though, is that for the union's point of view, is that that is something that's very common in our experience in London, that the levels of exploitative migrant labour in all industries in London are really quite phenomenal these days. And our view in all industries is to... you know, not take a view about the legitimacy or otherwise of a migrant worker. We don't take the view as a union that whether or not we try and support that worker is dictated by the immigration department or the agencies of the state. We would attempt to work, you know, with those workers. Not surprisingly, though, in this industry, like in many others, you know, the migrant workers, with all the extra exploitation upon them, are not the first to come forward, very obviously. And I'll just make one point by way of illustration. There are three factories in Park Royal at the moment. If anyone here buys their hummus in Sainsbury's, it's made by a firm called Katsouris, where a quarter of the workforce are exploited at migrant labour. If anyone buys DVDs and CDs in HMV or Virgin, it's made by a company called VDC in Park Royal, where 50% of the workforce are exploited migrant labour. You know, this is something that is actually, if you're going to try and organise exploited workers in London at the moment, as we try to, you can't duck this issue of migrant labour, and it raises all the problems and issues that you raised, in particular in this industry, though.
Thank you. Denise? Yes, I'd like to respond to the issues of unionisation. I have problems with this. One of the things that struck me when I heard about GMB and the work that they were doing was, I thought, well, who is the employer? Who does the union negotiate with? In terms of the lap dancing clubs and the table dancing clubs, that was quite clear to me, but it's like, what about for the women who are not in those places? What about for the women who are being held in flats, or the women who are working on street? Does the union then negotiate with the pimp? How does that work? Who do you talk to about rates of pay? Who do you take a grievance out against? How do you do the appraisal? And what about health and safety? You know, in our organisation, risk assessment is a big deal. How do you go around risk assessment when you're actually trying to work with pimps and traffickers? Sexual harassment, well, it seems it's a condition of the job. In terms of the lap dancing clubs, we've worked with women who've been in lap dancing clubs because they were allowed to go there if they performed well. If they didn't, they were taken out of the lap dancing clubs and were put into the saunas. We've also talked to women who've worked in lap dancing clubs where they say the management have been quite good to them, but what they have done is they fill up the lap dancing club. So the women have to pay at some of these clubs £50 in the evening before they start work. They then will bring in 100 to 150 women who are going to be working, and there are not enough clients. So the women end up being in the position where they have to offer more. That actually to get any money and to earn the money to pay the £50, they have to go that step further. Of course, in theory, the management hasn't made them do that. By filling up the club, though, they have very little choice. So, yeah, I do have a problem with it. I don't have a problem with some of the areas that you raise, but others, it's I don't know how you can take your subscriptions, quite honestly.
Maybe we'll take a few more questions before. Perona, will you come in the next round, perhaps? And I only looked this way before, so I'm sorry if I'm changing. Would you like to go first, yes? And you're second. And you're third. And you're fourth. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, the problems you faced with unionisation, the problems you actually said were to do with the industry itself. You didn't actually say that the process of joining the union, coming together, talking, finding out what other opportunities are, being educated. Now, having access to resources outside of your environment, I mean, that surely is a beneficial.
Absolutely.
Second question? Yes?
Looking for sex, but you find people that stop the labour, very serious past the mother,
Third one, from here. Thank you. Number four.
Thank you. Karen, I'm a graduate at the SBC. You talked about unions and laws protecting sex workers. Now, perhaps the question of criminalizing or decriminalizing not really answered, but as you suggested by Mr. Smith, laws protecting the workers is perhaps a better option. So that at least while they're in there, they cannot be further abused whilst trying to, you know, earn their living in however a way, whoever might think about it. But I mean, I don't see that as the real problem. If you have, if you unionize and give them certain rights and have them out, that's all well and good. But one question is, what pushes them there in the first place? As pointed out by Anna, not everyone is there because they enjoy. In fact, I would probably argue it's a very small percentage of people who actually enjoy a job such as that in the industry by and large. And secondly, and Dr. Sen, hope you can shed some light on this, we're dealing with very Western liberal societies when we're arguing about unionization and legalization or decriminalization or whatever of the industrial core. Whereas a lot of these people, and perhaps, I'm sure you're larger than mine, but perhaps the larger bulk of people who are abused by trafficking and forceful entry into the industry come from further east, where, you know, laws regarding labor in general aren't quite established they are here. And the trafficking really stems from further from Southeast Asia, and sub-continent, et cetera, and that region. What can be done effectively to combat problems there so that people from there, A, don't have to necessarily go down to this option, so that they're not pushed to that extent and are not trafficked? And as the lady pointed out, what can be done to make sure that there's a clear kind of difference between people who are forcefully being
Thank you. I'm going to take a couple more because I think a couple have been, I have three people down already, four because you had your hand up before. So if you could make them quite quick. I know, yes, one and then two and then three and then four. So if you, and then we'll take some more comments from the panel. Okay? Thank you. Speak up.
Well, the number of traffickers who have been prosecuted, lots of, and the women who have been trafficked once, twice, and all many times. And you mentioned that you
How can you provide an insight? What was the last bit? I'm sorry, the last bit. This question is specifically?
Yeah.
Okay, on insight research. All right. Yes, at the end. Yes, you. And then in front of you. So, yes, okay. Thank you. Yes, this is the last one, then we'll come back to the panel for a while, if that's all right. Thank you. Thank you.
Who would like to start? Thank you. Excuse me. Who would like to start from the panel? Purna, you didn't speak last time.
Oh, okay.
I think we have a sizable amount to be getting on with.
I don't know where to start, really. So I'm going to make a series of comments that might not be connected. Given the last comment, I actually have a quote here that you might sympathize with, actually. I don't get anybody's names, which is from the group Wages for Housework. And they made this comment in 1977 in New York when there was basically a murder. A woman was thrown out of a window in New York and, with some women protesting outside, and they discovered that the woman had been killed and thrown out of a window from a brothel, and there started to be some women's organizations, feminist responses to violence in the sex industry. And through that response, the sort of division that we've been talking about tonight emerged very, very clearly. And what the Wages for Housework group said was, prostitution is a job like any other job. Some women prostitute their fingers as secretaries, as you've just said. Others prostitute their minds as college professors. It's all the same. If we unionized brothels and recognized sex work as a job, this never would have happened. I think, you know, I think that parallel is a rather difficult one to draw. I think that sort of extreme polarization and drawing a link between them is one that doesn't hold a lot of water. I think there's a huge amount of difference between selling the use of your fingers and between being in an industry marked by levels of violence, rape, and sexual harassment that we know exists in the sex industry. I think that's a significant difference. And I think what we don't know yet, but we seem to be having increasing evidence about, is that legalization does not at this stage appear to have protected women from those levels of violence, rape, and sexual harassment. And until and unless that can be shown, then I think we need to be cautious about the benefits of legalization for women in the industry. I wouldn't want to say that no woman has or ever will enter any aspect of the sex industry in choice. I think that would be a foolish conclusion to reach. I don't want to say that no woman ever has or will choose to enter some part of the sex industry. But I think we do know that a huge majority, a very significant proportion of women in various parts of the industry are there, as Anna Maria and many others have said, because they don't have a range of alternatives. But the choices women make are constrained. And so there are constrained choices being made to enter the industry, and there are also women who are very clearly forced, tricked, trafficked, abducted, or kidnapped into the industry. So I think one has to be very careful about the conditions in which they work and how we seek to protect and improve their conditions there. I remain unconvinced, actually, so far that legalization has delivered those promises. Where there have been some studies, I think we have seen, certainly in Australia, that legalization has been seen both to increase the legalized industry and seen the brothels and other sex establishments being listed on the stock exchange, that their profit levels are going up very high, that they advertise in job centers for brothel keepers and so on. So it becomes very much a normalized part of life. But what we also see is that the illegal industry has grown alongside it. And we've also seen that levels of trafficking have gone up significantly with the legalization. So I think one has to be very careful about that. I agree absolutely with issues around stigmatization that people raised. I'm not convinced, again, that legalization removes the stigmatization. I think the stigmatization attaches to a woman when she behaves or is in this industry and engages in various types of sexual activity. And I think that attaches whether the industry is legalized or not. One of the hardest interviews I've done was with a woman who was in prostitution, and this was in South Asia. We were having a westernized conversation. This is a woman in South Asia, in Calcutta, in Shonagachia, an area of approximately 6,000 women working in prostitution, who said to me at the end of the interview, when I asked her, I was trying to end with something positive, which is a bit tough, actually, sometimes, if you talk to women in the industry. And she said her plans for the future were to continue working as long as she could be sold and bought, as long as men would buy her, She would send money back to have her children educated and married, her daughters particularly. And when her duties were fulfilled, she would then commit suicide because there was no way that anybody ever would accept her after that type of work. Now, that might be very starkly put, but I think it's very illustrative of the dilemmas with which women have to deal and the stigmatization that attaches and stays attached to many women in the industry. There was something else somebody asked me I was going to come back on, but I can't remember. So maybe somebody else can have a go.
Martin, Martin, do you want to address the issue that Denise raised, I think, and some of the others?
Yeah, I can do it if you know. Excuse me. Certainly, if people want to talk a little bit more about the dance clubs and much of what Denise said, we'd absolutely agree with most of the table dancing, pole dancing clubs. But fundamentally, I would agree what Denise said about the model, the normal, if you like, traditional 1970s industrial relations model of trade unionism is not going to work in most parts of this industry. The reason I made the comments by way of introduction from the GMB in terms of how we approach trade unionism is fundamentally to try and address this point. Our main attitude in the union is to say that the global economy is changing all the time. It is taking the workers into all sorts of different areas, even all sorts of different parts of the world. The principal need of the union movement at the moment, in our view, is that we need to fit ourselves around the needs of the workers that have approached us and asked to organise. Not try and make workers fit into a preconceived single model of trade unionism. So we don't expect to be negotiating pay with pimps. We don't expect to be taking up grievances and risk assessments in these situations. That is not a model, clearly, that's going to apply to this industry, and that's where we'd agree. So our model of trade unionism is not one of an institution bargaining on pay and conditions in return for a fee. We see ourselves as promoting self-organisation amongst all workers in this industry and elsewhere. And promoting solidarity, and as part of the global campaign for economic and social justice. And I make no bones about that. That is our model, that is our view of the role of the trade union. And we ask people to come in and contribute to the union funds by means of solidarity with their sisters in that branch and with that industry and solidarity elsewhere. When we take legal cases on behalf of the members of the sex workers branch, clearly the funds spent on that are provided by other working women in London, whether that's in the schools or in the factories or wherever, and as a solidarity there and vice versa. And that is how we see it being constructed. And I would actually say that, you know, the question Liz raised was whether or not unionisation and the intervention of unionisation will actually have an impact. We think it will. We think in some sectors of the industry it has. It clearly is going to be different in different sectors of the industry. But I have to say straightforwardly, even if we knew for certain now, for absolute certain, that it would make no difference, we would do it anyway, because our view is this: what kind of trade union, faced with the question that Anna put to us directly, and faced with the knowledge, sure and certain knowledge, of this level of exploitation and abuse that has been ably demonstrated tonight, what kind of union would walk away from that? Even if you'd know it's not going to work, our goal is to get in there and engage with that. And that's also why we fight against sweatshop labour in Indonesia making clothes that we all buy in Oxford Street. We don't know whether that's going to work. That's no reason not to engage. And so I do support the comments we made about, if you think about trade unionism as a 1970s industrial model, you're not going to see how it's going to fit in this industry. But that's not the model we're approaching. We're looking at a new approach to this industry and elsewhere.
Thank you. I'm going to ask Liz just for 1 minute, though. I'll kind of bring to your attention just briefly. We do have some outstanding questions, including issues of how to conduct research into the industry and some other questions that haven't been answered, but I do hope people are going to address some of that.
You also asked me, would I address this issue of are men exploited by leaflets offering them sex and money? And my answer to that is no, they're not. That is not an act of exploitation. That's an invitation, and they choose or don't choose to do something with it. I think there is an issue, though, that we don't want to engage with, and that we, I think, stereotype, which comes back to this issue about tolerance zones, because actually I know that the areas where it's safer and women prefer to work are residential areas. Undoubtedly, it's safer for them to be there, they prefer to be there. But actually there is an impact on that community and that area of prostitution being there. And it's not just the fact that people are illiberal or Puritan. It's actually that it has an impact on their daily lives and the safety of them and their children. when you have condoms and needles and all sorts of things in the street. These are real issues about the engagement and the negotiation that is going on between a number of parties in this. And we actually have to engage with this. There's a number of very difficult things here that are not easy to negotiate. I am not suggesting at all, I do not want women to be working in places where it's not safe. I mean, obviously, I would rather they weren't doing it at all, but that's not the situation that we're in. We're in a situation where they are, where it's dangerous. But actually, there are other issues involved that are not easily resolvable or negotiable. And I do think that this focus on that you can separate trafficking from the sex industry is one that people have tried to do at international levels, at local levels. You cannot do it. Trafficking for sexual exploitation is trafficking into a sex industry, and there's a demand from those sex industry owners. They order 10 women, 5 women, however many. This is part of what this industry is about. So you can't do a nice intellectual, well, trafficking is this concept and migration is this concept, and actually they're all mixed up together in a way that is very messy and is not easily dealt with. People want to say that smuggling is different from trafficking. Well, the problem is that many of the women think they are making a contract to be smuggled to work as an au pair in a hotel, and any number, domestic service. It's only when they get to the country of destination and their papers are taken away and they're said, no, you will do sex work, that it becomes not smuggling. So we want to, as intellectuals, have clear definitions, and actually the world doesn't work like that.
Thank you. I know we also haven't found someone to answer your questions yet on the figures of traffickers who've been prosecuted and also on women from the Balkans.
In the UK, do you want to know in the UK? I can't tell you exactly, but I can tell you that they've been at least 12 successful prosecutions of ones based in London over the last 3 years.
Emma. Okay. There's so many things that I would like to talk about, but I will only talk about legalization and about research, because I think that's a very interesting topic as well that doesn't usually is raised in this kind of debate. We've been talking a lot about legalization and how it hasn't delivered, how it hasn't been the answer to all the problems. And I totally agree to that, to a certain extent, to the extent that there isn't a country that I can look as a model. Because legalization has never gone far enough. It's just governments are not brave enough. There's too much taboo and stigma and noise around this for legalization to be taken to the full. So what some countries have done, like Australia that you talked about, is they have legalized some brothels, some working places, but not all of them. So of course you have this two-tier system that is, it's very detrimental to sex workers' rights. You're totally right. You've got a legal circuit that, okay, sex workers have more rights in that legal circuit than they had before, but you have a huge illegal circuit where people are made even more vulnerable, even more difficult to reach by support services. So this is something that it is very tricky. We have to look at this carefully. And if we're going for decriminalization, let's go all the way. And this is our branch's position. We're calling for total decriminalization, remove all the existing laws around prostitution. And yes, do have some regulation, because all other industries also have some regulation. But not, you know, but go all the way. That's what we're saying. And I would like to talk about research, because I am myself conducting research in the sex industry. And through my experience in these 4 years, I've heard this and read this many times. Sex workers are tired of being used as guinea pigs by researchers and not getting anything in return. When I started exploring the idea of doing a PhD in the sex industry, because I was working in it, because I was interested in the topic, I started by doing pilot interviews with people that I knew through my work and through activist groups. And the first question I asked, what I was really interested in getting from them, is what is important, what do you think I should be studying? And what I got from these pilot interviews were that those people that I interviewed, I agree that there's many, many voices, but all the people I spoke to at different kind of levels of how much they liked or disliked their job, but they didn't think that the job was itself inherently immoral or exploitative. It was the working conditions under which they were forced to work under the present legislation, stigmatization, etc. So that became obvious to me that that was what I had to address. But rather than just trying to understand a situation, I set myself to change that situation. So my research became an action research, and I said, okay, I'm going to try to understand this situation, but also do something about it. And doing something about it was to found the International Union of Sex Workers, and since from the beginning we're looking at formal recognition as a union. I'm getting a PhD out of this, but I'm giving something back to the sex workers that are not my informants. I'm not just going around them and taping interviews, but are actually participants in my research. And I think this should be done in any area, basically, but even more so in the sex industry, where, you know, historically we've been marginalized and not given a voice. We talk about, like, as if we were things, but we're, you know, not usually given a voice ourselves.
Thank you. Anna, Denise, did you have some? I was asked the question, how many women have I worked with who have enjoyed working in the sex industry and thrown off the stigmatisation? And the answer is none. The women who come to me don't come because they enjoy working in the sex industry. However, what I have had, because I sometimes speak at meetings and seminars, is inevitably people who come up to me to tell me that they have, or they know someone who has and who does enjoy it. And so I wouldn't say that that isn't true. What I would say is that for the majority of women that I work with, it is an unpleasant, abusive, violent situation. And whilst those women are there and that's happening to them, I will continue to campaign for non-legalisation and non-decriminalisation. The other thing I wanted to say, I feel kind of surrounded by the academics here, so you always feel a bit emotive when you speak, but it's the stuff around selling your fingers. I do the same. I sell my voice when I make the phone calls, and I sell myself when I come here. If I don't do very well, no one's going to give me a smack across the face. And that's what's happened to the women I work with.
Shall we have one more round of questions? Yes, number one, number two, number three. Anybody here? I've got my vision here. Number four. Okay. And then number five. All right. So I'll stop at five. Who did I say number one to? Over here. Yes. Sorry. Can we just wait for 1 minute? You do have to go, do leave. Well, not. You know. Feel free to if you must. Maybe we can have a round table in a minute.
Okay.
Have a round table in a minute. Is it nicotine break?
Yeah. Oh, you're right. Not allowed.
No, I wasn't going to. Oh, go on, have a chewing gum. It's just you'll have to speak very loud over the noise. You have a loud voice? Okay.
Most of the cases where there are no available legal recourse for
Number two was, yes, yes. Who was number three?
Thank you. Number three at the back.
Thank you. Number four was over here. You're going to have Weston.
Resonated, but at least it is not in media terms a sexy issue. It only very rarely hits the headlines. It happens every day. But to actually get those issues out there and discussed is very hard. But certain aspects of violence in the family do hit the headlines and get messaged in particular ways. And I think trafficking has become like that. And it's trafficking into the sex industry that's become like that. Because as we know, there's a lot of illegal migration. We will agree on that. There's a lot of exposure to labor. And you know, the GMP doesn't get those headlines, but other kinds of exploitation that they're also dealing with. You know, so I think those are issues that you know we all need to contemplate when thinking of you know how we actually message what we're trying to do about these issues in the areas of the media. And finally to all of you, I mean, how do you deal with the issues that we're trying to grapple with? One of the issues we're trying to grapple with in Amnesty International is looking at the threat of the HIV pandemic and other diseases which are particularly spread by violent and non-consensual sexual activity, of course exist, as we all agree. And you know, do you go for a harm reduction approach? Or do you agree with that? Is that giving too much, you know, to the issue of expecting women to have agency when people don't have agency? Or, you know, we want to take them out of the industry that we don't distribute from, on the other hand, to protect women within the industry to make their position be able to safer. You know, how do we deal with these actually very practical problems, whatever our ultimate goals are, how do we deal with those problems today?
I think that's I think we may just have to make that the last question, but let's see how we get on with the answers. Is that acceptable? Okay. Denise, I think it's your turn to...
Right. Okay. Harm reduction. Absolutely. The women that I'm working with and that my organisation works with, we have women in our accommodation. We also are working with women who are still working, and absolutely, I want those women to be safe. And until they're ready, it's not my choice to tell them when to come out. And I can see sometimes it's very difficult to do that when they may not get benefits, they may be deported, they may face a series of issues. So absolutely, while they are working, it's like I want them to have condoms and safety and good lighting and everything that they need to keep them safe. So, yes, my end aim is to go, we need to campaign and we need to find better solutions, and any woman who wants to stay in this country should be allowed to stay in this country, and any woman who wants to go back to Glasgow or Sheffield or Newcastle needs to be given the education and the training opportunities and everything she needs to be empowered. That's absolutely my end aim. But while she's in there, I want her as safe and as protected as possible. And I think that we all have a duty to do that. In terms of if we don't criminalise and legalise prostitution, personally, I'm sorry, I didn't understand the problem with the Swedish model. I think actually, yes, criminalise the men, criminalise the purchasers. That's all I have to say about that, really.
Who wanted to...
I have to get back to the issue of the Swedish model. I think Ellen's presentation was very clear, but just telling you from my perspective, when the Swedish legislation was enforced, the sex workers over there only had a very informal network going on, and it was exactly the problems that were brought by the enforcement of the legislation that gave them the impetus to organize and write to us in the UK and ask for help in order to unionize. So this is just to say that criminalizing the clients has not been an answer. And it hasn't brought anything positive for the sex workers in Sweden. They're just they were forced to do things that they didn't have to do before, and they feel that they're in a more vulnerable situation than they were before.
Thank you. I know those who go first get to choose more of the questions that they answer, but if I could just say briefly, we still have to answer or address the issues of the problematizing of the men and motivation for increased trafficking, and what might be, this is the question I think from behind, and also the issue of possible concrete measures in the meantime, which you have touched on also. But Liz or Perna?
I'm not. I just want to say I am not here to promote a particular model. I wish I felt I knew an approach that I felt delivered some of the things that I would like delivered in the medium term. I know where I want to be in the longer term, and that's to do with creating a world in which there is more justice and gender equality. And I actually think if we ever got there, unfortunately I do not think it will be in my lifetime, then actually prostitution wouldn't exist. But we're not going to be there in the near future. But I do think we need to discuss and we need to have in the room the fact that there are different approaches to this, one of which chooses to problematise the buyer, which in the vast majority of cases is men. And even if the Swedish legislation isn't particularly successful at a implementation level, it's important at a symbolic level. And the Swedes did not introduce it intending to implement it in a very heavy-handed way, and they haven't. What they introduced it for was in the same way that they introduced the law 20 years ago against smacking children. That in Sweden they see their law as setting normative standards, and the normative standard that they wanted to set around smacking children was that it's not okay. And they didn't succeed in making it not okay by prosecuting lots and lots of parents. They succeeded by changing the normative culture of their society, and that's what they think they're doing with this law. We'll have to wait 20 years to see whether they succeed or not. But I do think there are questions. I think it's very interesting that we spent most of the discussion talking about women involved in prostitution and how we should think about them, and is it agency, is it free, is it coerced, etc. And we spent very little time talking about the customers and what's going on, and why is it increasingly that they want to have sex with trafficked women. And this is part of what I think, if we're talking about the industry, we really need to talk about what is going on. There is some research. It doesn't make very nice reading, because actually what some of the men, not all of them, but some of the men who are buying sex say, is that they want to buy possession of someone. They want to be able to do to them whatever they want, how they want to do it, when they want to do it, and that's what prostitution enables them to do. They do not have to negotiate. There doesn't have to be any relationship. They can just say, I want this, I want it now, here's the money, give it to me. And some of them have even more, I think, very scary attitudes about what's going on and what they will do if they don't get what they want, and they are undoubtedly the ones who are violent and abusive. And this has to be part of our discussion about what kind of masculinities are constructed and reconfigured through the global sex industry. That's part of what I want to be on our agenda.
Thank you. Martin.
Yeah, I think it's something in terms of the question the sister at the back asked and sister down here, in terms of the nature, in terms of the nature of the demand. It's clear, I'd agree with Liz, it's got to be part of the discussion. I suppose in a sense the formal position of the GMB, of course, is the answer is we don't know. We don't know the nature of the demand, and there's not enough research been done on it. I have a suspicion that you asked the question, is it to do with the latent issues around masculinity and Liz, I'm sure it's partly that. I'm sure it's a number of factors. In terms of our work on working with migrant labour and the increase massively in our economy, in all sectors of economy, on the use of migrant labour and the exploitation of that migrant labour in the context of a globalised capitalist system which is beginning to commodify every part of our lives, I have a suspicion that the point that you make about is it as banal as the supply of strawberries, I have a horrible feeling or suspicion it may be related to that as well. I don't know. But certainly it is the case that we're, in my experience, the part of the reason for the exploitation of migrant labour in the economy and the other parts is simply because there's cheap labour supplied, and that may be an insight to one of the reasons behind it. But that's all the comment I could make on that, really.
I'm going to ask Perna to have the last intervention here, as it was your initiative, really, this. And I would like to say, as we probably, that's going to be the last last contribution then, before I thank everybody, which I will, so don't clap and then leave as soon as she finishes. This is, I think,
I wanted to ask if anybody on the panel had a really burning last point, as that is then going to be the last conference. Anything you really need to say before we ask Perna to say it all? Well, not all, obviously. Enough for tonight at the moment. Okay, can I ask then Perna Sen to conclude for us?
Oh, yes, but I can't answer all the questions that are left.
Oh, shame. There are some left, actually.
Yeah. I haven't read page 58 of the UN report or guidelines on, I can't remember what it was, HIV work. But what I am aware of in the UN system, it is not a coherent and homogenous whole, and there may be suggestions in places that the sex industry should be considered in terms of decriminalisation, but I'm also aware that elsewhere there are recommendations and suggestions which are quite to the opposite of that. And we know in the trafficking protocol, in Article 9.5, that states are obliged to undertake measures to deal with the demand for women in the sex industry. So I don't think there's one story about what the UN is suggesting we do. So we need to take care of that. I'm also aware and thoughtful about the timing with which there has been an increase in calls for legalization at the same time that parallels the concern with the HIV pandemic. And I wonder if there is a link between them. And I'm very concerned that the legalization and the mass distribution of condoms is actually, again, once again, about the control of women's bodies for public health reasons, similar to what we've seen around the Contagious Diseases Act. And I'm very concerned that the distribution of condoms is seen to be the answer to the solution to the problem, when it's clearly inadequate in dealing with the issues of negotiation of the sexual encounter that is simply not touched by distributing condoms. And I think those issues are still left untouched. Like Yugitha, you know I'm very concerned about the discourses and the pressures, the political pressures around certain issues and why they become attractive to the media and politically at certain times. I would like us to be able to talk about trafficking in its entirety. I do agree that conceptually you can separate trafficking from the sex industry. I don't believe in practice you can separate them. And I think it's also very important to remember other areas into which women are trafficked, such as into domestic work, into marriage, into repeated abuse of the relationships, and so on. Trafficking is a huge problem. The sex industry is very clearly linked to trafficking. Trafficking serves the demands supplied by the sex industry. It also serves a number of other demands for commodified women's bodies and women's services. But I would like to see, as Liz has already mentioned, that women who are trafficked have rights to protection, to support, to advice, to legal aid, and to remain, if they so choose, in countries to which they've been trafficked. That doesn't fit a government agenda. It doesn't fit the agenda of most of the media that we're surrounded by, which is busy demonizing migrant or illegal workers in this country. So we have to be very clear in saying, while we problematize trafficking, we also problematize the treatment of women by the government, which seeks to treat them as stigmatized, unwanted foreigners in this country. I don't think I'm going to try and answer any more questions, but I do just want to pick up the point that Gita made to finish with, which was, I was very tentative about having this debate. As I said at the beginning, what I've seen has been incredibly unpleasant and vitriolic in many places. But what I hoped we could do tonight was to see to what extent we could have a conversation across that divide and look at whether and how conversations could be had that find common ground and that seek to start to address the way forward. So I'd like to say thank you to the speakers who've come and done that today, because there were many who said they wouldn't come, let me tell you, and do this. So I think this has been a very important event, and I'm very pleased that it's happened and gone as it has. So thank you from me.
Can I thank, on your behalf, the speakers, Perna Sen, Denise Marshall, Liz Kelly, Anna Lopez, and Martin Smith. And thank you all also for some very interesting contributions and questions, and good evening, I suppose. Thank you.
Thank you.